Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Well, welcome everyone. Coming to you from the Toby Family Auditorium, it's Week to Week, the political roundtable for Wednesday, January 23rd, 2019. Welcome everyone to our program. Today, President Donald Trump sought to drive out Venezuela's president by recognizing the head of the national legislature as the new president. Nancy Pelosi saw that and said, "Now that's interesting." I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week. I'm very glad to have you all here. Tonight, we're going to discuss the government shutdown, of course, the latest with the president, Kamala Harris, in the presidential race, the Supreme Court, and whatever else we can fit in this hour. We've got a lot to get into. And, of course, we'll end with our live news quiz. It doesn't matter what your political views are. You're all welcome here. So any views that are expressed up here by us are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panel for today. On the far end of the stage is Carson Bruno. He's the assistant dean and adjunct lecturer at the Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, and you can follow him on Twitter at Carson J.F. Bruno. Next to him is Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico California Playbook. She's on Twitter at C. Marinucci. And next to me is Doug Sovereign, political reporter for KCBS Radio. He's also an author, and he's on Twitter at Sovereign Nation. So I think everyone here knows how we do this. There are question cards spread throughout the room. If you have questions, write them down. Someone will collect them and bring them up to me, and I'll try to work them into our conversation here tonight. Now, on to our roundtable. I had joked earlier that all I would need to do tonight is say, "So, what unbelievable thing has happened in the last 30 minutes?" And we would go on for 30 minutes, and then something else would have happened. I want to start with the government shutdown. There's been a lot going on, or nothing going on. It depends how you look at it, because it's still going on. There was news made today, but no progress. President Trump, who had had his invitation to give the State of the Union address postponed by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi until the government shutdown ended, he announced that he was going to give his speech in the House on Tuesday anyway, and a couple hours later, Pelosi said, "No, you're not." So, Doug, let's start with you. Are we all secretly pleased that there's not going to be a State of the Union address?
Yeah, having covered, God, how many of them? 30? I don't even know. I'm sure I can find something better to do with my Tuesday evening than the State of the Union speech. But no, seriously, it's always, you know, a big event in the political calendar. And it does appear right now that this one's not happening on Tuesday, because Nancy Pelosi made it very clear in her letter, "You are not speaking in the House chamber until the government is open again." And she has the authority to do that. If they don't pass a resolution allowing it, it's not going to happen, which leaves him with the alternative of speaking perhaps in the much smaller Senate chamber or finding an alternative venue, which they're looking for, some august building in Washington, maybe a rally format, maybe the ballroom in Mar-a-Lago. I don't know. You know, I could come up with some more risque suggestions, but I'm sure he can find another place to give it if that's what he wants to do. And I actually think it's a great political opportunity for him to do that, but I don't know that they're going to manage it the way I would.
Well, I mean, watching Nancy Pelosi this week has been fascinating. For those of us in San Francisco, I mean, 78, mother of five, grandmother of nine, Italian, knows how to deliver the goods. And I think she really surprised Trump, or has surprised him, I mean, with her move today. Basically, you know, talk to the hand. You're not doing the speech there. The polls, there's been several polls that have come out today, including a Politico poll. I think you
we
said
have a CBS
poll.
News one too, yeah.
You know, Trump's numbers have dropped into the 30s in terms of approval ratings. People are, by almost a 2-to-1 margin, not for funding this wall, and we saw developments today with regard to votes taken in the Senate on this issue. This is, you know, the bottom line is, just even an hour or so before we got here, you had the airline pilots, air traffic control, putting out a letter saying, "This has become so serious, we don't know at what point the public safety is at real risk here." I mean, God forbid something should happen, but at this point, you've got air safety endangered. You've got law enforcement furloughed.
Border security.
Yes, I mean. This is now becoming something that is so severe that I don't think both sides can continue on without some kind of breakthrough. It looks like there may be something legislatively there, as the Democrats might go for more funding, but for border security only, not for a wall.
Mm-hmm. Just a few things to kind of add on to what both Doug and Carla were saying here. I mean, first off, regardless of ideology, regardless of partisanship, everyone knows just how smooth of a player Nancy Pelosi is in Washington, D.C., both within her caucus, but then as speaker. She really knows how to maneuver and manipulate, not in a bad connotation way, but in a good connotation way, the systems of Washington, D.C. And so for the White House thinking that they could outplay her, it's a worrying standpoint, because it really goes to show the novices that they have kind of within at least their political department within the White House. The second point, State of the Union. The Constitution only says that the president has to report to Congress, I think, from time to time. Yeah. It doesn't say what that, I mean, George Washington was not giving a televised State of the Union address in front of, I mean, Congress. He would write a letter to them. And so there's a lot of opportunities for the Trump White House to do what is constitutionally obligated of them, but then to make it their own as well. And so it doesn't have to be in front of the House. It's just people think it has to be because that's the way it's been done for most of our lives. I mean, all of our lives, if I'm not mistaken here. So there's a lot of different opportunities there for the White House to do. And then finally, on the shutdown itself. You know, it's been kind of odd. I would say I'm kind of average-ish as an American, but the shutdown really hasn't affected me all too much quite yet. I had to renew my passport last month, and I got it within less than a week. And I was like, wow, I wasn't expecting this at all, even with the government operating. But for someone who flies a lot, it's in the back of my head, even stepping onto the plane to fly up here, and I'm flying back down to LA right after this, you know, of the what-if scenarios. And that starts to creep into the everyday person's life, whether they are regularly relying on the government or not. And that starts to become a really bad political situation for the White House, particularly, because Nancy Pelosi knows, and she said it today, if we give in to him, he's just going to keep on coming back and shutting down the government whenever he wants something. And so she knows what the situation is, the hand that he has played at this point in time. And they're not willing to give him that. And so now we're stuck in the situation of what do we do?
Yeah. I do think the shutdown is obviously seriously hurting real people. Yeah. Government employees, I mean, we've interviewed some of them. I mean, people who can't pay their bills and are in great distress. And
the ripple effect of many businesses that are having closed down or empty.
One of Trump's senior economic advisors said, look, our growth is going to go to zero if this lasts much longer, and nobody wants that. I do have to say, I am stunned that anyone in the White House could be surprised by how effective Nancy Pelosi is. I mean, have they not been paying attention? I know she hasn't been speaker the 2 years they've been there, but a lot of people said she's going to run rings around this guy when she gets to be speaker again, and that they could not anticipate how good she is at this and what her moves might be does speak to how inept they are politically, even midway through his term. I mean, by now, they should have a sense of how things work.
Elsa just goes to show you again, regardless of politics, just how bad of a speaker John Boehner and Paul Ryan were. they really couldn't grasp the actual power that the speaker truly has from both just a bully pulpit perspective, but then also a functionality perspective as well.
And I think the question is now, where do we go on legislation? What do we see in terms of what kind of compromise they're going to come up with? The Republicans have proposed things which the Democrats view as poison pills, that is, real restrictions on asylum seekers from Guatemala, Mexico, from Central America, which is a non-starter for the Democrats. They've also proposed very heavy penalties for those who lie on any of their, people have put down false information. I mean, which raises a question. Remember, AP did a report a long time ago about Melania Trump and her own work and visa issues. There are a whole range of issues that the Democrats are not going to accept that the Republicans have tried to push as the shutdown goes forward. And now the Democrats, you're starting to hear them say, look, we will go with border security and smart border security. The Democrats are saying they're not for open borders. They want smart borders, but
which they've funded before.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I think this is where it's going to come down to. You might see a change on that $5.7 billion and Democrats moving toward that, but absolutely not for the border wall.
But we are to a point now, what scares me the most of it really going from affecting everyone, really, is that it's not just a policy battle anymore, it's an optics battle.
Right.
The Democrats cannot let the Trump White House win on anything that can be construed as the wall, and President Trump cannot let the Democrats win on anything that's less than the wall.
Yes, absolutely.
So you're in a position now where the optics are more powerful than even the policy or the details, the fine print, and that's a very tenuous place to be in
when it comes
to what can actually reopen the federal government.
And the Democrats read the polls, they see that they're winning on this issue, so why should they give in?
Well, and someone from the audience asked something along those lines, hasn't Nancy Pelosi painted herself into a corner by calling the wall immoral? So she can't give in for the wall. It would have to be some sort of
different
way of calling it. Yeah. But at the same time, Trump has painted himself into the wall, hasn't he, by saying this is all about getting the wall.
Yeah. I mean, he just tweeted today in capital letters, build the wall.
Build the wall and crime will fall.
Yeah, I mean.
And then Kellyanne Conway got very mad at CBS for asking the question in the poll about the wall, saying it's not a wall anymore, it's a barrier. We said steel slats. It's like he tweeted today, calling it a wall.
Yeah.
But I do think, I mean, to some extent, it's semantics. So the Democrats can say, okay, here's $2 billion for border security, but not the wall. And Trump will say, well, we're going to use some of this for the wall. He didn't even use last year's money for the wall. What that money from different pots actually pays for, as long as the Democrats can say it wasn't for the wall and Trump can say it is for the wall, everyone can come out saving a little bit of face.
But I think just generally, this is why we're at such a dangerous point. We don't know at what point the lack of services and government, employees and what they do for us is going to cost lives.
We are seeing the stories about people who can't get their medication paid for. Not as far as lives, but as far as impacting broad groups of people, I would put forth when people can't get their tax refund.
Yes.
And even though they've ordered them back, there are a lot of them who are now saying, can't do it. I think that could be a
we reported today that on February 1st, a lot of the money for judicial, for the courts begins to run out. What happens then? The impacts are going to grow greater and greater. And this is a more and more dire situation.
Let me then throw this out to all of you. And someone asked something along these lines, which is, we think some of the stuff is putting pressure on various politicians and political groups, but isn't this in some way a long-term strategy, or not strategy, but goal of certain people on the right, which is that we don't want the government to be effective, meaning we don't want it to be big, we don't want it to be doing a lot of these things. So if it causes disruption, and remember, a lot of people voted for Trump to just get in there and to be the bull in the china shop. So might he be a little less susceptible to people really screaming that they can't fly, they can't do this or that than
the people who goaded him into doing this are small government people. And
the Ann Coulters of the world.
Yeah, and a lot of people will look and say, oh, the government's been shut down for a month. I didn't notice. I guess they don't do much, and they're not that effective. Who needs all this government anyway, then?
Yeah.
And the more it doesn't affect people day to day, the more easier it is for people to say, oh, yeah, we don't need so much government. Let's shrink it down.
Yeah.
That does play to his ideology, if that's his ideology.
But I do think that's the exception and not the rule. I think most of the Republicans up there on the Hill understand the impacts on average people. The question is,
and most of his base.
I mean, and on his base.
If we're assuming, and there's a lot of evidence to say his base is the white working class folks, you know, from the flyover parts of the country, mm-hmm. those are the people who really do rely
on most dependent on the federal government.
On government in a lot of different ways, not just the federal government, but also the trickle down from the federal government to the states and then, you know, to the localities. So, I mean, that's starting to squeeze on them too. So it's this is looking toward 2020. I mean, definitely.
Everything he does.
Once November 2018 occurred, everything is now looking toward 2020. Both for him, he's not that stupid. He realizes an election coming up in 2020. But then also for the Democrats, and the Democrats are now in a position where they don't have a party leader per se. Nancy Pelosi is their party leader for all intents and purposes. So she needs to basically hold the entire Democratic Party together, the Senate's in the House, activists all across the country, basically waiting for whoever their nominee is going to be. And so she needs to basically kind of hold the steadfast together and ready to go for someone to come into the Democratic House and not the House of Representatives to really lead the party forward to take on Donald Trump in 2020. And so they're both looking toward this issue right now in the lens of 2020. And it's a precarious place, I think, more so we're seeing in the polling, but then also just thinking about who his base is. It's a more precarious place for Donald Trump to be than it is for Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats.
Someone, I forget who, joked that federal employees could get their revenge because when Donald Trump files his tax return, it'll be reviewed by an IRS employee.
He's still under audit, as far as we know, from before the election, right? He wouldn't release his returns.
How long is the audit coming?
The world's longest audit.
A couple questions I'll kind of put together and answer them as you will. But one person asks, will the shutdown drive bipartisanship? And I wanted to ask about, you know, the bipartisan gangs in the Senate. But also kind of a related question, and that is, why is not more said about Mitch McConnell's responsibility for this debacle? So...
Yeah, he's kind of getting a pass on this, isn't he? He's sort of laying low and staying out of it and let Trump be the face of it. Pelosi, let them go head to head.
Right.
Because it's kind of a no-win proposition for him.
No, but I think that his ability to lay low is coming to an end. There has to be some kind of action. As Trump's poll numbers are falling, Republicans are watching mm-hmm. those numbers, and they're looking also to 2020. Yeah. And there, you know, it's danger. That red light's got to be flashing. He's not going to be able to continue to go to the side and just pretend it's them, not me. Right. And the Senate is going to have to act in one way or the other.
And for 20,
oh, go ahead.
For 2020, it's not just Trump. It's also the Senate,
right?
And the House. And so, I mean, when you're Courtney Gardner, when you are, I mean, Lisa Murkowski, who's not really in too much trouble ever, but
Sue and Collins.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of situations where you throw the presidential race into the Senate mix, a lot of weird things can start to occur. And for someone like Mitch McConnell, he is definitely looking toward that because he wants to be the majority leader until he's mm-hmm. dragged out of there on his deathbed, basically, it looks like. And he is probably an equal match when it comes to how to maneuver Washington, D.C. to Nancy Pelosi. He knows the Senate through and through, just as much as Nancy Pelosi knows the House through and through. They both know Washington. They both know how to kind of anticipate trends and seeing kind of where things go to make sure that they are, at least they may not be themselves popular, but at least they are leading a caucus that is maintaining a majority. So pay attention to what I think McConnell does, especially when you have people like Cory Gardner from Colorado and Susan Collins starting to be a little bit more vocal in what's happening.
And I do think the end game is something bipartisan, at least on the surface. There will have to be some sort of resolution, something that they can call a compromise, but I would not look for a spike in bipartisanship. It'll last as long as it takes to cut some sort of deal and get it passed, and then we'll go back to what we're seeing now.
The difference, however, is both Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell are dealing with a wild card, which is Donald Trump. I mean, yeah. He has been a wild card since he rode down that escalator in Trump Tower. Yeah. That every insider, anyone who knows how to maneuver kind of what is the political status quo in the United States politics hasn't really been able to anticipate and kind of figure out quite yet. While I think both of them have done really well in kind of that vacuum, they're still, I think, trying to figure out what he does and doesn't do.
Yeah, and I think we don't know what's ahead for the wild card, yeah. Donald Trump, when it comes to Bob Mueller.
And how he might act as a wounded animal as things close in even more on him.
That is the
right.
Big...
Yeah. Well, let's get into Mueller in a little bit right after this. So exit question for this section. Along those same lines, though, of McConnell, does this mean the solution... The deal that will have to be made will be made between McConnell and Pelosi, and how is their relationship?
I mean, to some extent, yes, although remember, they had a deal before, and then Trump vetoed it.
Right.
So
yeah.
They have to know that whatever they do is also negotiated in concert with the White House, or there is no endgame.
Yeah.
It has to be something he'll agree to. So really, it's between Pelosi and Schumer and Trump and McConnell and McCarthy, all of them together. Because there are three parties here, and Trump's not just going to sign anything.
Right. I mean, McConnell has said they're not putting anything forward unless they know the president's going to sign it. So it's got to be.
I mean, he was goaded into this in the first place by the talking heads.
Right.
I mean, so you can't assume that whatever has a majority in both the Senate and the House is going to be then signed at the end of the day, and that signature is. A necessary component.
We'll have to check with Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter.
Yeah, so
make sure that's okay with them.
The power pyramid is Ann Coulter and Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So the other big news in the last week, perhaps, was the bombshell report from BuzzFeed that President Trump had instructed his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about Trump's Russian business dealings. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's office... issued an interesting denial, and I kind of want to get into how much of a denial or how broad of a denial do you actually think that is.
Right.
Maybe start with you, Carla.
Yeah, I mean, I think the BuzzFeed report, I mean, the reason that it was covered so widely because of the allegation that President Trump suborning perjury, that is such a serious allegation, and it's a game changer. With the Mueller statement, I know... We as journalists have been there where your report can be correct, but perhaps one detail of it is not exactly how the source sees it. Going back to Watergate, Bernstein, Woodward and Bernstein had a similar situation where I know they had one major error that they had to apologize for during the course of reporting, but basically the facts of what they had reported were correct. So I'm holding off on a judgment on the BuzzFeed report. I think the fact that the reporters and the editor of BuzzFeed have come out and said we have gone back to our sources and we are 100%, we stand 100% by this story, tells me a lot. I think reporters don't do that unless they have gone the full length. So we're going to see how that comes out. If that is true, as you've heard many people say, this is something that is going to change the whole picture and change Trump's political fortunes up there. It could really change the whole impeachment question.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Cohen now has postponed his testimony before Congress because he says he's getting threats from the president himself against his family. So we won't find out necessarily as soon as we all wanted to see him be asked in 2 weeks. Did the president tell you to lie when you came here? And how that gets handled? Well, now we're not going to see that. We don't know when it's going to happen. He's supposed to go to prison in March. So who knows if he'll ever testify at all before Congress.
Although I think Adam Schiff, the head of House Intelligence, has said they still want, even whether they have to subpoena him or not.
They may have to subpoena him.
Yeah, several of the Democrats on the Hill have said they're outraged. They believe that Cohen has been intimidated. This is witness intimidation. So we're going to see whether they hear from him or not.
But I do think
you can't go to prison if the prison is closed for the government shutdown.
That's a good point. But yeah, witness. So you could add witness intimidation as another potential crime this president may have committed. I mean, if it is true that he told Cohen to lie, that's actually four crimes. It's suborning perjury, it's obstruction of justice, it's aiding and abetting perjury, and it's conspiracy. Any of which is an impeachable offense. In the aggregate, it's you know, a huge bombshell. And I'm with Carla. I tend to believe the reporters because I am one. And the fact that in Buzz, first of all, the denial from Mueller's office didn't say this is false or this isn't true. It said the characterization of the documents and the evidence is not accurate. Well, that's not quite the same thing. And BuzzFeed then responded saying, please tell us which part of our report is not accurate, which is a unusual thing for a news organization to do, and shows that they're pretty confident that they're on solid ground here. So It was sort of a non-denial, nuanced denial, which in itself, we never get anything out of Mueller's office, so to even get that was extraordinary. But I assume, I mean, very few of these things that have been reported have turned out not to be true by all the news organizations throughout this process. So,
including by these two reporters. So
I give the journalists the benefit of the doubt until we see all the evidence ourselves.
Carson?
I mean, the only thing I would add to this is that to look at it from the Mueller investigation side, in that while I've sat on this stage many times and I've said that he's a very good investigator, he is, but he also knows the political environment that he is operating within and going to be walking into whenever a report is issued. And so it needs to be as tight as it possibly can be, but also as impactful as it possibly can be. Mm-hmm. Because if it's not impactful, then it's too easy to get swept up in the 24-second news storm that is our what we operate within today. So he needs to make sure that everything is kind of on point, factually, backed up, you know, sourced and moving forward, but then also that it is really making sure that it is there. I mean, it can stand on its own two legs and be able to run once he releases it.
Yeah. So. And you know, we should note that this comes in a week where Giuliani, the president's attorney, has done like backflips all over the place with regard to what was the president in discussions with the Russians on Trump Tower heading into the election. The president himself has all but said, well, you know, I wasn't sure I was going to be elected, and, you know, why would I give up business? He actually said that on camera. So, I mean, the story has changed on that part of it so many times that, you know, this is about to get very, very interesting when the Mueller stuff comes out.
Yeah, Giuliani will change what he's saying between the beginning and the end of a sentence.
The question, the question actually, just to jump in here, the question, and I don't have an answer for this, but the question is, at what point do the Democrats withhold any sort of impeachment? So let's say that Mueller does something before the 2020 elections. Do they proceed with impeachment and potentially overextend their hand? Or do they kind of let it roll out in the political arena with the election itself? Because as a Democrat, do you really want a President Pence?
Well, that's the thing. And the other thing is, if you're Nancy Pelosi, that's her worst nightmare. If the Mueller report is as damning as we think it might end up being, it will be impossible for her to stop the impeachment forces in the House. Because too many of the new members of Congress and too much of the Democratic base is going to say, you got to get rid of this guy. Look at all these crimes he committed, and forget politics. Just as a matter of law and principle, a president accused of these crimes, you have to have impeachment hearings. And I would imagine she will not be able to keep that from happening.
Because I know Mitch McConnell would much prefer a president.
Sure. Pence. Then the question is, does the majority of the House, is the majority in the House and two-thirds in the Senate, or is it two-thirds in both? Majority of the House vote to impeach. I mean, that could go either way. Probably they do, maybe they don't. But there is no way that two-thirds of the Senate will convict, in which case you don't have a President Pence. You have a Trump who stays in office and says, see, I'm not guilty. I was acquitted. I've been vindicated. And you don't want that either. Yeah. And Pelosi has said many times she'd rather have a wounded Trump twisting in the wind than go through a whole impeachment proceeding and have him not removed from office. Mm-hmm. And if he is removed from office, then Pence is president, which the Republican Party would certainly prefer. On the other hand, there are senators on the Republican side who are not going to concede the presidency to Pence. And if that were to happen in 2019, Ben Sasse and Tom Cotton and
a
number of other people.
There'd be a number of people lining up to take a shot at that one
in 20 in the primary. Yeah. So that would help you. And maybe they vote to convict to give themselves a chance to run for president. I mean, there's a whole sort of nefarious scenario going on there.
Yeah.
It could become very HBO.
And we may see it. You know, I don't know if it's House of Cards or Game of Thrones, but maybe a little
of
both.
Very Game of Thrones, right?
Break down the possibility of what happens if Trump does not run in 2020. So say he's not impeached, but he makes the decision not to run.
That's not going to happen. The only way that happens is if it's clear that he's committed all these crimes and the people really turn against him, and I mean his base, not just the other two-thirds of the country, and his own party goes to him and says, look, you're going to kill us. You got to get out of here. Then he makes up some excuse about his health, whatever. But this is a man who filed and declared his reelection bid on the first day of his presidency. No one has ever done that, ever. He has been raising money and running since January 21st of 2017. So his ego is too great. He knows that a one-term president is a loser. A one-term president is a failure. Right. He wants the second term that stamps him as one of the greats.
Yeah.
So he will not do that unless his back is to the wall.
Or unless perhaps his family is somehow implicated.
They might all be in prison by then.
That may be the question. But I agree with you. Once you have this kind of power, especially he seems to be enjoying it very, very much. Mm. I don't think he's giving that up. He's going to be dragged out of there
kicking and screaming. Yeah. Even if he were impeached and removed, he might not leave. I mean, they might have to. Who knows what? You know, he'd be like holding on.
Okay. In other Trump news, there is other Trump news. The president says he told Sarah Huckabee Sanders, quote, not to bother, unquote, with press briefings because the media was being too mean to her. Carla, I know how much you love White Houses that don't want to talk to reporters.
But right.
What do you think about this?
I mean, this is outrageous. This is just outrageous. What is she getting paid for? I want to know. I mean, the idea is these White House briefings are about more than just public relations for the president, although that's what they've turned into. There are some people who say, you know, at least she's brought both Democrats and Republicans together because Democrats don't think she says anything that's true in these briefings, and Republicans hate the, you know, fake news. The bottom line is these are forums for the White House to publicly respond to questions and to be held to account. And that is what it's about. And as somebody said, if she can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. There have been plenty of presidents. We've watched them all. Remember Helen Thomas. I mean, we could go back generations of reporters who have sat there in those briefings and given hell to the person at the podium. Mm-hmm. And if she can't take it, then she needs to get another
job. Come on, she still goes on Fox and Friends every morning.
Yeah. And that is the irony. I mean, she is an exclusive spokeswoman to Fox and Friends now. And how is that working out? I mean, we know people, including Deborah Saunders, who you've had here at the Commonwealth Club, is a good friend of mine, who's in those briefings every day. On both sides, there's conservative media and mainstream media and liberal media in that room. That's her job, is to answer the questions. That's what the taxpayers are paying for. She's not doing the job.
And it's also, as you say, it's a forum. I mean, there are real issues, policy issues that come up every day. You know, arcane matters in more conventional times. Those briefings are not necessarily live on TV, and they're not as interesting to everyday people. But complicated issues of public policy that people need answers on and need to discuss, and that's not happening.
Right. And the president's Twitter feed is just not enough to answer those questions.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
I, I mean, I don't have much too much more to add to that, to be honest. I think the average person doesn't watch those nor pay attention to really what's happening in the press room at the White House or for any of the departments for that matter, except if something bombshell goes viral. But I mean, communication is a vital part of the function of government, regardless of what level you're at. If you're at City Hall in Santa Monica, if you're here in San Francisco, at Sacramento or Washington, D.C., having accountability, having transparency, and having communication is vital. So it's what we expect, I think, as Americans, as voters, as kind of anyone, as just citizens. It's a core piece of the calculus.
And also, the White House says, well, she answers questions. Reporters can come get their information from her. She's still there to do that, just not from the briefing podium, to which I say, I mean, it's a matter of efficiency. If all the reporters are there and one asks about Syria, now everyone has their answer on Syria. They can move on to water policy or whatever it is, as opposed to 27 people all saying, hey, I need to talk to you about Syria. I mean, this is not a good use of her time. I mean, the briefings are there for a reason.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about some California politicos. And that means talking about 2020.
Mm. Yes.
I hate to break this to you. So there are now 9 announced Democratic candidates for president in 2020, at least as of several hours ago.
We're just getting started.
Some of you might have announced since then. earlier today, let me pronounce this correctly, Pete Buttigieg.
Buttigieg.
We'll
mayor of South Bend, Indiana.
Yes, thank you. He's the latest candidate, hoping that that post as mayor of South Bend, Indiana, will be the usual springboard to the White House that it has been.
We're going to have 3 mayors maybe running for 3 or 4.
That's true.
It's unprecedented.
Because Eric Garcetti is one, Mike Bloomberg, possibly.
Mitch Landrieu from New Orleans.
Yeah.
Might run.
I mean, people who are already announced are Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Elizabeth Warren, Julian Castro, Tulsi Gabbard, if I pronounced her name correctly, John Delaney, Richard Ojeda, and Andrew Yang. And don't worry, some of those names you'll never hear again. But some of those names, I suspect, are going to be heavy hitters in the eventual big primary. So that's kind of what I wanted to start off with, this being California. Carson, do you think Kamala Harris is going to be one of those big heavy hitters?
Well, first, I am thrilled to finally watch not just the junior Democratic debate, but the junior Democrat debate after having watched all of the Republican debates with the cacophony of individuals that the Republicans had over the last few cycles. So I'm thrilled to finally have basically entire evenings of debates amongst the 3 dozen candidates that appear to be, thinking about taking on President Trump. Coming back to California, I mean, if you think about California, it's been a while since a Californian has really been truly talked as like someone who has a chance at the nomination. And so it's pretty exciting, especially given then when you think about how in the blue Democrat or the blue California is. And so it becomes a very big part of the Democratic Party. It becomes a very important piece of the Democratic persona. And so it's only natural for, I think, for someone from California to really be kind of in the mix there. But it's not just Kamala. Eric Garcetti, mayor of Los Angeles, is being talked about. I've been hearing kind of rumors here and there about Gavin Newsom. Is he preparing? He's a little bit presumptuous. Eric Swalwell, from up here as well. So, and Tom Steyer took his name out of the hat. But
Adam Schiff is going to Iowa this week.
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot of folks here. But, I mean, California is a big prize. But it's less of a big prize now, oddly enough. They moved the calendar up for the California primary into March, the idea there was to really kind of be more influential in the mix. But they moved it up to a date where there's a lot of other states happening. And so there's still going to be a rather large pool of candidates at that point, and under proportional kind of the how the delegates are assigned proportionally, even if Kamala Harris is still in it at the time, which I feel she probably will be, even if you throw in Eric Garcetti and some other kind of random candidates who can appeal to different constituencies within California, that's not that big of a prize for the Californian. Whoever it may be. So it's actually not to the Californians' benefit to have California as early as it is. So they're getting into a lot of baseball politics.
You know, the California who will benefit, though, the media who are going to get advertising from a whole bunch of candidates.
Yeah.
Our bread and butter.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
I was just going to say, once again, California has tried so many times to be more influential in the presidential race. It has moved up now to the point where we'll be probably fifth in line, but it's become Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
That I think it's March 5th, is now, you know, Texas and, I don't know, eight or 10 other states will be the day. So it's not like we're going to have it all to ourselves the way New Hampshire or Iowa do. So you're right. The impact will be diluted.
Or if we did in June, if we stayed at the date and there was maybe a battle between two or three people, then it'll be, it'll be decisive at that point.
It could be the decider.
Yeah.
So it'll be diluted by the sheer number of states and, as you say, the way they divvy up the delegates, and the fact if there are three Californians running, you wouldn't expect Kamala Harris to run the table. And also, the fact that there are going to be Californians running will change the expectations for California. Other candidates may say, California, they have the most delegates, but they're all going to win anyway. We're going to focus on these other states.
Yeah.
So then if she doesn't win California, it'll be a loss. Or if she doesn't win by as much. So I think you're right. It'll have less impact than it might have otherwise. But I put her very much in the top tier of candidates. I mean, I look at that list and there's 18 or 20, you know, who may actually end up running, and maybe 14 or 15 are legitimately viable. I mean, to me, the top tier is Biden and Sanders and Kamala and Warren and, you know, maybe Cory Booker. And if Beto O'Rourke runs, I'd put him in the top tier too.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at who's in the race right now, Kamala is at the top, the front runner, more or less. I mean, the B's are not in there. Yep. Beto, Booker, Bernie.
Biden, Bernie.
Bloomberg. If they get in, that might change.
Killer B's.
But the fact is, right now, she's in a great spot. She's doing her big rollout in Oakland on Sunday at City Hall there. The whole country will be watching that, or the political scene will be. And she's got an interesting life story, and she's got some... I think what her strategy is to kind of be a middle ground, in the sense of she's got that prosecutorial background. A lot of people like that. But at the same time, she's a progressive Democrat, is talking about tax cuts for the middle class. She's talking about bail reform. She's talking about women's health issues. I think as a woman, an African-American and Indian-American woman, this is somebody who has a really interesting history. And I think as a communicator, she's formidable. You've all seen her.
Yeah.
And that is going to be a big strength. When I look at her compared to some of the other women in the race, I think she's going to be...
She has a charisma and an energy that stand out from the pack. I do think, you know, she's being very smart in that she's presenting herself as a front runner. She's running as a top tier front runner and presenting herself that way and not looking for a niche, which is great because it's a broader appeal, but it also runs the risk of having her appear inauthentic because she's not progressive enough for the true progressives. She may be too liberal for the more moderate, say, right of center Democrats. So she won't necessarily be anyone's perfect cup of tea because she's trying to appeal to everyone. So she does run the risk of, you know, who are you really? But I do think her rollout and her strategy so far have been very savvy.
I think
she's only really, and this is not a knock necessarily on her. There's a lot of candidates that this can be applied to on the Democratic side in this election in particular. But she's only really had one truly tough election, and that being her first run at the Attorney General.
Yes.
Although her races expanded. For DA were tough.
At a big level. And you can think of California, running an election in California is kind of a mini nation in itself. So that's really her toughest race. Her re-election, yes, the Attorney General, was a cakewalk.
A landslide.
And then she's waltzed right into the Senate seat.
Yeah.
So you can kind of see that both, especially the Senate seat election, her being very, and her team being very wise and tact tactful about essentially eliminating any of the true competition and allowing her to really get to a place where she didn't have to have a good a tough election. And so that could be a really big benefit on trying to winnow the field, it's particularly as you go into Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and the early states. Yeah. But it also could come back to backfire because she hasn't had to take the punches to the jaw, where some of the other ones have had to do that through their career, while other ones definitely haven't had to yet as well.
I think it is interesting that Dianne Feinstein has said, no, I'm not endorsing Kamala Harris.
I prefer Biden.
Of course, they've been in the Senate together for so long. I happened to be at the MLK celebration in Oakland this week. I caught Barbara Lee there, who's from Oakland. Said, how do you feel? And she said, well, I'm glad, it's great that Kamala's getting in, and there's Black lots woman. Of progressives in the race. Mm-hmm. She was very careful not to endorse Kamala Harris. So we're going to have to watch and see.
Well, the fact is, I mean, people like Barbara Lee and Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi, too, for that matter, they're from a different generation. They have a lot of close ties to other people who are going to run, and they're part of the machine, the establishment. Yeah. And Kamala is too now, but she's newer.
Yeah.
And as Feinstein even said, well, she's new around here. I don't know her that well yet. She loves her, but she just doesn't know her that well. And they don't owe her the way, they've seen Biden.
They think
Biden would be a really good president, and they know him well. And I mean, Biden will benefit from being the establishment candidate. He'll have the endorsements. He'll be the institutional candidate, which might win him the nomination, but as we saw with Hillary Clinton, being the institutional candidate does not always win you in November, probably because you don't excite the masses who care.
And these increasingly important millennial voters,
Joe Biden.
That's right. And one of the strategies I know that the Kamala Harris team is going with is her support among African-American women. They're going to South Carolina. African-American women being one of the most reliable, loyal voting groups in the country. And they've made a difference in many races. And so Kamala Harris is going to South Carolina. She's meeting with her Alpha Kappa Alpha. Mm-hmm. That's a huge African-American sorority. 300,000 women, that group is.
Right.
The first African-American sorority ever founded. And that is a very loyal group. I don't know if you saw, they had a convention here in San Francisco. They took over the entire city. They are
and
really
she's the
together.
First
yeah.
Member of that sorority ever to run for president, obviously.
That's right. Yeah.
They're
and she's
excited.
There with them this week in some southern state. I can't remember.
No, she's
but
very
she's
smart.
Also, her connections with historically black colleges like Howard University, where she came from. She's parlaying all that, and I think that's very smart on her.
And she will try to reassemble the Obama coalition, which other Democrats will have a harder time doing, and that is her kid. Remember, she was the first person I could think of who endorsed Obama for president.
I covered her
early.
In Iowa, in the snows of Iowa in 2008, working for him. She was way early.
DA of San Francisco, she got out way out on a limb. I'm endorsing him, and he hasn't forgotten that, and he's helping her and advising her, and she could, you never know. He's told her, you could catch lightning in a bottle. I did. Go for it.
But for her and her team, they should be looking more toward 2016 and the Republicans 2016 than Obama, than even the Hillary campaign on 2016, because a lot of weird things can happen when you start to have 12, 13, 14 people running in these early states and stuff happening on the debate stage that are completely out of your control if you are the perfect candidate. And this is not a 2008 Obama versus Hillary, John Edwards kind of playing.
Except
off the
there
side.
Is no Trump figure in the Democratic field.
Tulsi Gabbard. Could throw a serious wrench into the situation. Mm-hmm. Don't count out Elizabeth Warren. She knows how to fight.
Yeah, that's true.
And really appeal to people you would not think that she would be capable of appealing to. Mm-hmm. Sanders showed that you can really create a constituency out of nowhere, being the gadfly in Washington, D.C. for as long as he was, and then really kind of surprising
if he gets in
everyone.
Again.
When you start chopping up the electorate, and again, remember, it's not a lot of people actually voting when we're talking about the caucuses and the primaries even.
Right.
It's a lot of weird things can start to occur. Having the support of AKA is huge, but something else could happen that you're completely. And so if they are smart, they're looking toward what happened What happened to Jeb Bush? What happened to Marco Rubio? Right. What happened to Chris Christie? Yeah. These people who are supposed to be the front runners and supposed to just wipe the slate clean. And what happened there? Because those are the lessons to really pull from.
Absolutely. So a wild primary season followed by what's probably going to be a very vicious, brutal general election. So out of 18 candidates, whoever loses will face Trump in the general election. Well, let's stay in California with Governor Newsom. Carla, did you go to his inauguration?
Yes, I did.
So he has been
a whirlwind of activity since that inauguration, where I think he laid out very much what he was about to do with his little son Dutch running up to him. that was a million-dollar photo op,
sure
and
was.
Yeah, he's ever, since then he's been doing, I would say, an event every day and rolling out some really big initiatives. This week it was criminal justice with juveniles, wanting to take them out of the
corrections
and put them into human services. He's talked about, you know, drug prices, making them far more competitive, lowering drug costs. Of course, early childhood education. Mm-hmm. There's just been, I think, we haven't seen, you know, people were used to do Jerry Brown, who, of course, accomplished a lot of things, but Jerry Brown was not this, like, whirlwind of energy that we've seen from Newsom, in part because he spent the months running up to this election with 30 different working groups. I mean, the guy is a policy wonk to the point of, you know, we were there for his budget rollout where he spent 2 hours running through the entire budget line by line. He loves budgets. I mean,
he is a policy wonk.
He'll dive into any issue at great length and wear you out. Yeah.
And he has spent months, years getting ready for this.
That's right.
And has a plan and has his ideas and is ready to put them to work and implement exactly what he said he was going to do, which is what he's doing.
One interesting thing about this real fast is that he's walking a really fine line where he actually got praise from Republicans and Democrats on that budget because he's going to pay down the debt, you know, pension reform, CEQA reform, stuff that they like, but then he's also doing the progressive stuff.
Which is easy to do when you have a $21 billion surplus.
Yeah, exactly.
And just a handful of Republicans to please.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. No, I mean, you would hope that he was doing something in these first few weeks because, I mean, he's had 8 years to prepare for this because lieutenant governor doesn't really do much. So he's had a lot of time to sit there and daydream in his WeWork office here in San Francisco or wherever he has been. It's been interesting because I didn't know Gavin Newsom as mayor of San Francisco. I knew him really as lieutenant governor and kind of everything he was doing then, which was very showmanlike, very kind of flashy, it's kind of hard to pin him down of where he really was. Was he for the high speed rail, against it? Where is he now? We're not really too sure. Very much kind of this persona that very much was looking towards something else to do. And so I really kind of expected him to come out guns blazing with really kind of turning Sacramento back into really kind of what it was in the Schwarzenegger days of this glitz, this kind of high profileness, this all about showmanship, and less really about the details. But he hasn't done that. I mean, so that's, for someone who has been skeptical about kind of will he actually do what he's been saying he wants to do, I'm somewhat hopeful that he will.
Well, I would say, I mean, having known him and covered him for a very long time, since actually before he was in politics, he does do what he says he's going to do because he's all about the ideas and the policies. And I mean, this is how he was as mayor, and I think he will govern the state, at least for the beginning, until he loses interest and thinks about something else. The way he governed San Francisco as mayor. I mean, he gave an 8-hour State of the City speech that he rolled out in a series of videos. I mean, we've covered a lot of inaugurations and budgets.
Yeah.
And typically what happens when the governor unveils his budget is he comes out, whether it's Brown or Schwarzenegger or Pete Wilson or Gray Davis, and they do the introduction and they maybe get through a half an hour of the high points and some charts. And then they say, thank you very much, and leave. And the finance director comes up and takes over and takes you through the nitty gritty. We never saw the finance director on stage. Yeah. Gavin Newsom stood there for 2 hours and did all the nitty gritty himself and would have gone for 2 more hours if we hadn't all run out of batteries and ink. I mean, he really likes that and gets into the, and you can talk to him. If you ask him about something, you're going to get a 10-minute answer, and he'll talk to you for hours if he has the time.
Yeah, yeah. And I did an event with him, or covered an event with him this week, or last week in San Jose, where he talked about the whole housing issue. Sat there and listened to people who had lost their housing, could not afford, middle-income people, and he seems to be particularly concerned about that. How are these workers who are in tech? He really wants to move tech to provide more housing. He's talking about a carrot and a stick. These communities, if they don't build housing, they're not going to get transportation funds from the gas tax, and that's how he's going to help push that. We'll see how that goes, but the fact is, there's some pretty ambitious stuff, and that's why I think people talk about, like, Gavin Newsom, the White House, would he possibly run? I think, mark my words, as governor of California, he automatically becomes a future, a Democratic future presidential candidate. Maybe not in 2020, unless everything blows up and people turn to him.
2024 or 8.
Yeah.
Depending on what happens in 2020.
When you look at what he's proposing, people say, watch what he's proposing, because if it's laid out as something that would work as a future White House,
federal level.
And that's exactly what he's doing. It's going right down the middle. Both sides seem to really like what he's doing. He's progressive, but he's fiscally sort of on the conservative side, and that is a formula for future.
And I do think, he's said to us over and over again, I'm not running for president, I won't, oh my God, it'd be horrible, I can't imagine anything horrible, but 2024, if Trump's reelected, 2028, if he's not, he will be running, and
yeah,
there's no way he can.
Certainly young enough to do that.
We've
right.
thought that since he was mayor.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you mentioned it's been a while since anyone from California. No West Coast Democrat has ever even gotten the nomination, let alone won. The only Californians ever to be president are Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon, and Nixon really did it from New York, not from California. He'd moved to New York by then. Pete Wilson had a token run for president, went nowhere. Alan Cranston. Jerry Brown obviously ran a few times, but we haven't had a viable California Democrat running, so it will be interesting to see if Kamala Harris sustains hers.
Yeah. I also think one last thing is that the fact that he has four little kids under 9 years old, and they are clearly a part of what he does all the time, that is a big change up there in Sacramento. People are just like stunned to watch, little Dutch come up on stage, etc. And his wife, Jennifer Sybil Newsom, who's now the first partner. Mm-hmm. She's been designated and has her own staff now. She's going to try, it's been announced, advance issues related to women's health and so forth. Mm-hmm. Look to her to be somebody that's going to be watched also, because she already has a constituency with her misrepresentation project, or documentary that she did that's very, very well known about sexism. And
also, I will say, having those four kids really has changed Gavin Newsom. He's a different guy.
Yeah.
I think of him as back when he was this hard-partying wine store guy, and he's changed, and his perspectives. I have a couple of young kids, and it's true, it changes your perspective on life, it changes your priorities, and you're seeing it in the policies that he's prioritizing. And I don't think it's all just lip service and showmanship. There's a degree of that with him, but he sincerely seems to get it. He's got little kids, and that's what he's focusing on.
Okay. A few things that I'm going to be really paying attention to is how does he use particularly the other statewide elected offices. Mm-hmm. Typically, you tend to see them kind of all operating in silos, separately, independently. Yeah. That there's really no sort of coordination, no sort of effort to kind of really kind of come together as a team, despite the fact that they really ought to, given the intersections and overlap of what they're all doing, particularly when it comes to lieutenant governor. For someone who sat in lieutenant governor's seat for as long as he did and was really kind of pushed aside time and time again, he himself has talked about how worthless of a position that is. Will he bring in Elena? And I'm going to butcher her last name.
Eleni Kunalakis.
Yeah.
Will he bring her in to be a partner in a sense for the administration?
Will he bring
in Fiona Ma? Yeah. Will he bring in the Betty Yee, all the other ones to really kind of create
Fiona Ma, you've got a number of women now in statewide office. I think he's not going to ignore them. We've already seen Eleni Kunalakis, who's from San Francisco, was an ambassador to Hungary, has quite a good portfolio when it comes to trade and other issues, and that seems to be where they're going to be working together
because
on that.
If you can get all of these, you know, 7 statewide offices, plus then the entire kind of the executive office of State of California operating together on one cohesive kind of message or agenda, then some of these really big issues facing the states, whether it's housing, water, healthcare, whatever it may be, can really be tackled. If it's just the governor trying to do it by himself, he maybe will get the legislator kind of go along with him. But if he has some of the other statewide officials going along with him, then you can really see some really kind of amazing things, yeah, I think, happen.
Well, I will say we were both at the inauguration of Quinlocus, lieutenant governor, and he made a great point of saying we're going to be a team, yeah, in the way that hasn't been before, and we're going to work together. Of course, they're all interested in working with him because they all want him to appoint them to Kamala Harris's Senate seat when she gets elected president. So I think they will at least initially try to work together.
Okay, briefly before we get to the news quiz then, I wanted to talk about the videos we've all seen regarding the confrontation that took place after the March for Life between those Catholic school kids from Kentucky?
Kentucky, yeah.
Native American elder and... Then it turns out in the later videos we saw a group called the Black Hebrew Israelites, who it was an interesting mix.
Right.
And of course, people jumped on. This became one of those social media outrage opportunities. I'm kind of curious on what you thought about it and what you think about the way politicians, this being a political program, have handled this or tried to make use of it.
I think my heart just broke watching that video because this is where our country's at. There they are in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial with malice toward none, with charity for all. And this kind of scene is going on. I think that scene was a Rorschach test. I mean, basically, if you, somebody said, tell me what party you belong to, and I'll tell you how you saw that video. And that really sort of was true in a lot of ways. There were many different, subtleties in terms of what happened there. But I think no matter what you believe, I think President Trump missed an opportunity here by praising these kids and inviting them to the White House without inviting the Native American, Mr. Phillips, as well. I mean, he could have used it as an opportunity, as Lincoln said, to bind the wounds of the nation. Instead, taking sides in this, I think that was a complete missed opportunity on his part.
It's not his style.
Yeah. And, I mean, it just showed what a divisive moment we are in this country. My question was where were the adults in this this situation?
Yeah.
Why did no one step forward and say and break this up and try to defuse the situation? No one did. I still don't understand.
Well, the Native American leader was attempting to be the adult.
Yeah,
in the mix.
Yeah.
And there were adults, their chaperones, their teachers from the school who said, "Go ahead and do spirit chants to the boys and jump up and down and I will say though that for Fox News and the right, this is the perfect thing for them. I mean, it made the left look intolerant, it made the media look biased, and it made white men look like the victims. And that is why they're running it nonstop.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, today on Fox News, I saw a crawl that said media fake news still blaming Kentucky boys, calling them racist. I mean, it's red meat for Trump's base, and they'll play it as long as they can. It was really unfortunate. And what's interesting to me, though, is when I first heard about it over the weekend on social media and said, "Oh, have you seen this?" I got a little clip of the boy standing there in front of the Native American man drumming, and I'm watching this boy sort of with an odd grin on his face, and you can, whether you decide that that's a smirk or just a friendly smile is in the eye of the beholder. And then it ended. I said, "Wait, where's the outrageous part? Where's the bad part? I'm waiting, like, that's it? Like, show me the bad part." I kept thinking there must be more, and eventually there was more. But I didn't understand why the reaction to that little clip got so enraged, and maybe you can help me understand that, Carson, because I thought, wait, I just see a bunch of white high school boys from a Catholic school acting like white high school boys from a Catholic school. Well, I was waiting, looking for something more.
But it should also be noted that some of the online accounts that were pushing this out fueling the flames,
right,
were, I'm sure, Russian connected. Bus. You know, these groups that have been known to be doing this and other fights. That's exactly what the Russians wanted to incite this kind of division.
Yeah, yeah.
And right. I think this is just another example, and there's lots of them that, particularly in the Twitterverse and the social mediaverse and the quick turnaround of mm-hmm. both news and then commentary, right. is to just take a deep breath.
Yeah.
And wait. And see what else starts to unfold. Now, when I go on Twitter, yeah, I flip through. But I'm not making any opinions or judgments until I start seeing more stories come out about whatever it is that seems mm-hmm. to be blowing up the Twitterverse at that particular time. Because sensationalism often tends to be a little bit... now, there's a lot to unpack on this story, so I'm not saying it's an story. But there's obviously a lot to unpack. And what initially started the firestorm was just the surface level that there's a lot more to do, to understand and kind of figure out. And then, by all means, make a judgment, make an opinion, mm-hmm. And kind of go along with it. But take a deep breath.
On that note, let's get to our news quiz. So if we could have the lights come up, I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. You can shout it out. If you're correct... I believe Fran is my chocolate delivery person.
Oh, chocolate.
He will deliver some chocolate.
I just
want to
go on the record that I've always found out of here that we don't get any of the chocolate.
You got some great Fiji water.
Yeah,
great Fiji brand water. It tastes like water. As seen at the Emmy Awards.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I was going to say.
First question. Glenn Close hopes to break the longest streak of Academy Award nominations without a win, including her nomination for her role in The Wife. How many Oscar noms has she had? Mammy, right along the edge there, you were first.
Seven,
that is correct. Oh,
wow. I didn't know that.
Wow.
Yes.
Susan Lucci of the Oscars.
Yeah. Susan Lucci had like 25.
Former GOP House Speaker John Boehner sits on the board of Acreage Holdings, a cannabis company. Mm-hmm. But that clout didn't stop the company's ad for medical marijuana from being rejected by CBS for airing during what? See, I couldn't throw a whole bunch of chocolate to all of you because you all answered at the same time. Fran's nicer than I am. Okay. Next question. Raise your hand and I'll call on you.
Don't shout it out.
That's a horrible question. It was depressing, and every so often if I get a bunch of negative ones. Like, what's something good? How are TSA agents at JFK Airport in New York taking out their frustration at the government shutdown? Way in back there? No, this is specific to JFK. Did anyone see these stories? No one? They are playing loud rap music over the speakers, uncensored.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, my God. That'll hurt business.
That'll do it.
Okay, at Davos, Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff says San Francisco is a train wreck, and he said who or what was to blame. Right there in the second row.
The tech industry.
The tech industry, that's correct.
Didn't he win already?
He already won.
Did you? I didn't ban it, but...
Okay.
Okay, Fox News on Monday apologized after they showed a graphic that suggested who had died in the light back there along the back.
Ruth Bader
Ginsburg, that is correct.
Hi, Bob.
She's very much still alive. What singer is giving furloughed government workers free meals at his New Jersey restaurant? Anyone along the side there? No. John Bon Jovi, that is correct. In case you need a free lunch, it's the JBJ Soul Kitchen in Red Bank, New Jersey. So head on over. In a new poll of Democratic candidates matched up against President Trump in 2020, who beats Trump? Right there in the front, sir.
Everybody.
Every single one of them.
Yes.
That is correct.
That's right.
You could have said any name in the world.
You got it right.
Yes. In fact, Trump was at 41, 42% for every single Democrat. He didn't get above, basically, his base.
Right.
So that.
What was the most any of the Democrats got? Do you have that?
I want to say it was in the 50, high 50s.
Yeah.
But, you know.
53% for Biden.
For Biden.
There it is.
Biden.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. A DNA test has proven once and for all that what Nazi was not replaced with a doppelganger in prison? Right there, sir. Rudolf Hess. That's correct.
Good.
There was a rumor, or some people believe that Rudolf Hess had, you know, he died in Spandau prison after the war, and that some people believe that he had been replaced in prison with someone else, a doppelganger, someone who looked like him but was not him. Okay. In Berkeley, any Berkeleyites here? Probably a few.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So if you go to get your coffee at the coffee shop, you might want to bring your own ceramic mug, mm-hmm. because if you don't, you'll have to do what? Sir, in the back, right along the edge there, yes. Pay 25 cents for a plastic or disposable cup. That's correct.
To go cup.
And I'm not doing a good job counting. Fran, how many left?
Three.
Do I have three good questions? Well, here's one. The Vatican's Swiss guards, they're replacing the metal helmets that they've used for 500 years. They're replacing them with new helmets made how?
Ooh, I don't know.
Okay. Anyone?
Almost everything.
Somebody over there?
Yes. That is correct. 3D printing.
3D printing? They're 3D printing their helmets?
Yeah.
Wow.
The Vatican is on the cutting edge.
That means they'll be plastic, though, right?
I didn't.
Very Da Vinci.
Not like
it
won award, but.
What if they're attacked? There'll be plastic helmets.
Fox News anchor Bret Baier now has something in common with Britain's Prince Philip. What is it? Along the wall there.
I know that one.
He was in a car wreck this week. Yes. Both the prince and the anchor are.
That's right.
Doing
okay.
Well.
They're okay. Yes.
And I believe, finally, like many people today, I had to go to Google to learn how to pronounce South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg's name. Now, the name is Maltese in origin. According to CNN, what does it roughly translate as?
Oh, wow.
What does it translate? Way in back there, I see a hand.
Lord of the chicken.
Lord of the poultry. You got
yes.
it.
Wow.
That's correct.
Good job.
Congratulations. We'll have lots more news quiz questions and much more to talk about on our next program.
Better than Lord of the Flies.
On Wednesday, February 6th for our next week-to-week. And you can find our week-to-week news quiz on the news on the website. Thank you to our great panel today, Doug Sovereign, Carla Marinucci, and Carson Bruno.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you here tonight, everyone watching and listening online. Have a great rest of your week.
Lord of the Poultry.
He confirmed it for me, so you don't have to care.